Welcome to this Thursday's Main Street here on Prairie Public. We are glad that you are with us. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Coming up in just a bit, a case of mistaken identity that raises red flags about AI. And smart tech you can wear, plus a deadly tiger attack reigniting debate about cat ownership. And we begin today's Main Street with our weekly podcast, A Closer Look with the Monitor. This is A Closer Look with the Monitor. I'm Craig Blumenschein from Prairie Public. North Dakota's tax landscape is shifting. A major homeowner tax credit is proving more expensive than expected, with the state now needing roughly $20 million more than originally budgeted. At the same time, new limits on how much local governments can raise property taxes are creating tensions for cities, counties, and school districts trying to balance their budgets. To help us understand what's happening and what this could mean going forward, we're joined by North Dakota Monitor reporter Mary Stoyer, who's been covering this issue from Bismarck. Mary, welcome back to A Closer Look with the Monitor.
Hello.
Let's start with your reporting. What did lawmakers learn this week about the cost of the homeowner tax credit?
So State Tax Commissioner Brian Crotius, in a committee meeting, told lawmakers that by his estimate, the program would probably cost about $20 million more than budgeted for this current budget cycle.
And the reason is because it's been popular. Is that right?
Commissioner Crotius said that more people know about it now that the program's been around for a few years. Lawmakers also raised the subsidy from $500 to $1,600 each year. And so Commissioner Crotius was kind of saying that that's pulled a lot more people in to, you know, go out of their way to apply.
Did they give statistics, Mary, on how much that change from $500 to $1,600 has influenced participation?
No, they didn't give specifics, although another part of it is that the application window for this year hasn't closed yet. It closes April 1st. But last year, I believe the participation rate was already at 95%. So, you know, it was already most eligible people applying.
Mary, I want to point out to listeners that they can go to tax.nd.gov/PRC. That's the primary residence credit website, and they can begin the process for their primary residence application if they want to get that in before the deadline that you just mentioned. Mary, from the state's perspective, how big of a concern is the shortfall? Is a $20 million shortfall manageable? Or from the state's perspective, is it signaling a larger issue?
Lawmakers didn't seem concerned during the meeting. Commissioner Crotius did mention that back when the budget was passed last year, he did tell people he didn't think the appropriation would be enough, and so that the state should expect for his agency to have to come back to ask for more money. So even though this expense wasn't penciled in, it didn't exactly come out of the blue either.
Along with this issue of property taxes, of course, is the property tax cap. And that means that communities cannot raise taxes more than 3%. Why was that put into place, Mary? What's the feeling behind the reason why the legislature really needed to do something with what some people may have thought were runaway taxation problems?
Lawmakers for a long time now have said that it's been a major goal of theirs to try to keep property taxes in check, because that has so much support from voters who feel like it's getting out of hand. So last session, they passed House Bill 1176, and that included the primary residence credit, but also this 3% cap. And so this was put out there as a major way the state legislature was trying to, you know, do something about property taxes. And by limiting how much they can increase every year, they were trying to send the message to voters that, hey, here's some assurance that your property taxes won't keep going up at larger and larger intervals.
You had a chance to speak, Mary, with local government groups who are saying, hey, this is a problem for us, I think. What are they telling you, and what are they telling lawmakers about how the cap is working so far?
A handful of Local government associations spoke to lawmakers during the meeting earlier this week, and they said that they had conducted informal surveys of their members. So, you know, officials from various local government groups across the state. And they all said a lot of the same things, that implementing the tax cap the first year was kind of difficult for them, that it made planning their budgets more difficult, that they're worried that different expenses related to operating governments are going up at a rate that outpaces the cap, which means that they are worried that they're going to run out of money for services and have to cut spending in various different ways. They also seemed to be confused in some ways on how to implement the cap. Like, maybe there were some things about the law that weren't clear, or they struggled to get clarity on. And so there were just a lot of administrative tangles is what they expressed too. So a lot of different concerns.
Mary, you reported that some communities say they're dipping into reserves or delaying projects. How widespread is that concern?
This was one thing that wasn't clear from the meeting, although lawmakers said they wanted those government associations to come back with more data on next time the committee meets. So Senator Brad Beck et al. On the committee, he said in his experience working in local government, he doesn't think it's unheard of to normally dip into reserves, although it's unclear if this cap is pushing people to dip into reserves more frequently. The surveys, the informal surveys that the local government associations conducted, didn't specifically ask whether or not it was common for the people who responded to their surveys for their local governments to do that. They didn't really gather data over a period of time to show whether or not this was happening at a greater frequency. So to be determined. They're looking into that though.
Mary, I should point out that local governments have retained technically the ability to ask voters to exceed the cap when they feel it's appropriate, but that's not happening too much yet at this case. Mary, the phrase tax fatigue came up in testimony and in your reporting. How significant is that politically?
This was a phrase used in testimony from the former mayor of Horace, Corey Peterson, and he said he spoke at the end of the meeting kind of after he heard local government, those local government associations talking about the results. And he mentioned that there might be some hesitancy on the part of local governments to try to increase the cap because they don't know that voters would respond warmly to that, so to speak. And so they kind of seem to express being in a situation where they don't like the 3% cap. They have this potential avenue to increase it, but they don't have faith that that would be worth the effort. Potentially, I should say as a caveat, this was sort of a conversation based around those informal polls, and there wasn't enough conversation to really get a solid sense if that was the truth, but that's sort of what some committee members and some people who offer testimony were guessing was the root cause of some of this.
Are there ideas now that are forming or proposals forming that may adjust the law in the next legislative session, whether that's raising the cap, tying it to inflation, maybe adding exemptions? Are there new ideas being tossed around?
There are. The legislative committee hasn't really bit on any specific policy change. They said that it's kind of still too early on in the year for them to look at specific policy changes, although those make come up during their meeting in June. One interesting one that was raised was, like you said, specific exemptions for specific costs, like emergency services, etc. The Association of Counties even proposed having an exemption for election costs, because the cap doesn't really consider the fact that counties every other year have to pay for elections. And so, you know, their budgets look very different from year to year. how do you implement that with a cap if there are sort of like inconsistencies with the budget in that way? So I think that I'll be really interested in particular to see whether or not lawmakers are amenable to discussing that. There are still kind of a lot of different ideas being floated around, and the committee hasn't decided on a specific direction, if any, that they would take.
Lawmakers, I think, initially indicated they expected adjustments. What's the timeline for potential changes?
I believe the deadline for communities to propose potential ballot measures for the general election to change the cap would be a couple months out of the general election. And then, of course, any actual policy change to the law, to state law, would have to be proposed in the 2027 session next year, early next year.
I guess the point of the conversation is stay tuned. There's more to be talked about and decided, but homeowners should be paying attention right now, especially with the April 1st deadline for the tax credit looming, so to speak, and that website address is tax.nd.gov/PRC for the primary residence credit. Listeners should go there if they have not yet applied for that credit. Mary, stepping back, based on your reporting, do you feel that North Dakota thinks they're striking the right balance between tax relief and maintaining local services, or is there a lot more work to do?
That's a good question. And that was kind of a major question that seemed to be hanging above everyone's head at the committee meeting. I think lawmakers, at least a few of them, sort of signaled that, like, hey, we gave the people what they asked for. Local governments, if you want some of your taxing authority back, you need to fight for it, like present it to the voters and have them decide. And I'm sure, on the other hand, some of the representatives of the local government associations would say it's not that easy. You know, like, this has created a lot of administrative hurdles for us. So remains to be seen. I think they'll be talking through that question a lot this year and in the coming years.
That's Mary Stoyer. She's a reporter with the North Dakota Monitor. She joins us from Bismarck, and you can read more from Mary and her colleagues at the North Dakota Monitor at northdakotamonitor.com. A site that is free from subscriptions or paywalls. And I'll add that no one covers state government like the Monitor does, Mary. So congratulations for your work. You can always read her full reporting at northdakotamonitor.com. For a closer look with the Monitor, I'm Craig Blumenschein. Thanks, Mary, for joining us.
Thank you so much.
The Minot Symphony Orchestra will present Ode to Joy on Saturday, March 21st at 7 p.m. as part of their centennial season. The performance includes the MSU Honor Soloist, the world premiere of the new Minot Anthem, and Beethoven's Ninth Symphony featuring over 200 area choir members, as well as MSU alumni guest artists. Tickets are available at MinotSymphony.com or by calling the box office at 701-858-4228.
This week on Prairie Beat, a Fargo case that's drawn attention. A Tennessee grandmother jailed for months after being misidentified in a fraud investigation. What happened and how did it take so long to unravel? We take a closer look.
Angela was booked into her county jail in Tennessee as a fugitive from justice from North Dakota.
And I've never been to North Dakota. I don't know anyone from North Dakota.
Hey, I'm Eric Etheridge.
And I'm Danielle Webster. We are back again for another episode of Prairie Beat.
A closer look at North Dakota news from the newsroom of Prairie Public. Now, Danielle, a story that started here in North Dakota but has really gotten some legs on it and traveled all over the world in the last week. Wow, is the story of Angela Lips. The short version is this. She's a grandma from Tennessee who was misidentified as a suspect in a bank fraud case in Fargo, and she spent several months in jail. She lost her home, her car, and even her dog before eventually being let go. Really dramatic reporting from our colleague over at WDAY TV News, Matt Henson. Well, he reported that she was arrested at gunpoint by U.S. Marshals while babysitting her grandkids.
Yeah, you know, it really is quite the sensational story. Last week, Fargo Police Chief Dave Zabolski announced his retirement from the police department. He's going to be leaving at the end of this month. And at that news conference where he made that announcement, Matt Hinson asked Zabolski why nobody at the police department had spoken to Angela Lipps for the 5 months she spent in jail. And the chief at that moment declined to answer that question. But that was the first time I myself had heard about Angela Lipps, and I kind of had a feeling that it wouldn't be the last time.
Yeah, no kidding. I think it really took off. Story has these legs going all over the world because the main headlining narrative of the story was that she was identified by AI facial recognition. And in a day and age where people are using AI more and more, well, that aspect may have a lot to do with people skeptical about its use and its efficacy, especially in law enforcement. People are undoubtedly asking and questioning, could this happen to me?
All fair to consider, absolutely. I was able to sit down with Chief Zabolski this week to discuss all of this, but before we get to that, it's important to know the nuts and bolts of the initial reporting, because that specifically was the chief's main thing that he wanted to address. So as we already stated, Matt Hinson produced this report for WDAY TV News. He wrote that last summer, Fargo police used AI facial recognition to identify Angela Lipps as a suspect in a bank fraud case. They had surveillance video of a woman using a fake military ID to withdraw tens of thousands of dollars from a bank here, and this program identified Lipps.
According to the court documents, the Fargo detective working this case then looked at Angela's social media accounts and Tennessee driver's license photo. The detective wrote in his charging document, Angela Lipps does appear to be the suspect based on facial features, body type, and hairstyle and color.
She was arrested July 14th, and since she was considered a fugitive, she was held without bail. The report goes on to say officers did not bring Lipps to North Dakota until October 30th, and she had her first court appearance the next day. Her appointed public defender is an attorney named Jay Greenwood, and Hinson reported he immediately wanted her bank records.
Her bank records showed she was more than 1,200 miles away at home in Tennessee. At the same time, police claimed she was in Fargo committing fraud.
Around the same time she's depositing Social Security checks, around the same time she's buying cigarettes at a gas station, around the same time she's buying pizza at one of the places, around the same time she's using Cash App to buy Uber Eats.
Well, the bank records thing almost seemed too easy to me when I saw that part of the story.
She was interviewed by police in Fargo on December 19th, where her attorney brought that information. And after a bit of follow-up and additional investigation, they agreed to drop the charges. Hinson then reported Angela Lipps was released from jail and then basically was on her own.
But Angela was now stranded in Fargo.
And I was just scared to death. You know, I had summer clothes on and no coat. And it was so cold outside and snow on the ground. I was scared about that too. You know, I wanted out, but I didn't know what I was going to do. How I was going to get home.
Fargo police did not cover Angela's expenses to get home after her release from jail. Local defense attorneys gave Angela money to pay for a hotel room and food on Christmas Eve and Christmas Day.
Hinson went on to report that Adam Martin, the founder of F5 Project in Fargo, drove Angela to Chicago on December 26th to meet up with family in order to get home. And the rest of the report outlined how reluctant the police chief seemed to respond to the entire ordeal.
Well, that report, as we alluded to earlier, has really gotten some miles on it by now. Now, over the weekend, it was reported by The Guardian, which is overseas, right? I think it's British.
Mm-hmm.
Many other stations around the country as well have picked up on the story. I think last week I said, Danielle, this story is going to go worldwide. And sure enough, even People Magazine is sharing it too. The story did not leave out that Angela lost her home, car, and dog, nor did they neglect to mention that a lawsuit may be coming for the city of Fargo as a result of what happened.
Yes, and reporters have had questions for sure. We were offered time with the chief yesterday, and what he had to say was like, okay, so that's the reporting, but it's incomplete. And truthfully, I was waiting for that because a lot of what has been discussed in social media specifically is like, oh, AI did this and it screwed up this woman's entire life. But Chief Zabolski says it's not that simple. You can't just get accused of a crime and then end up locked up for months.
So the police are the investigative arm. We go to the call, we investigate the crime, collect evidence, conduct interviews. All of that information is then placed in an official police report, and it's sent to the state's attorney's office for review of potential criminal charges. We work hard to ensure that our investigations are objective and thorough before we send them to the state's attorney's office. But that doesn't mean that at some point the state's attorney reads it and goes, hey, there's some other follow-up I'd like you to do to help prove the case one way or the other, or outright just decline the case and determine that there's not enough here to issue a charge.
Once a case is sent to the state's attorney's office, they then send it over to a judge who reviews everything and has to agree that there is probable cause in the case, and then they issue a warrant.
So I guess depending on who you might ask, either every step was followed properly here and they just unfortunately got the wrong person, or there was a systematic failure on multiple levels that caused an innocent person's life to be upended.
There are always multiple sides to a story, yes.
Okay, well, Danielle, one of the questions I have is about the length of time this all took. Indeed, if this was a case of mistaken identity, I feel, and I think a lot of public perception around the story is that, why couldn't this get cleared up before Angela Lipps lost her home and everything in it?
It's a great question. Matt Henson laid out a pretty detailed timeline in his story, and when I went to meet with the chief, they gave me a typed out timeline of dates and all the details and everything that happened, and these timelines do match up. The fraud investigation started in April and May of last year. Angela Lipps was arrested July 14th. The authorities in Tennessee, according to Zabolski, did not notify the Cass County Jail that she was available for extradition until October 20th. And Lipps says during that time, she was never spoken to by anyone in North Dakota. But since she wasn't in North Dakota's custody yet, Zabolski said they would not be able to do that. He also said he was not sure why it took that long to get her to North Dakota. She was booked into the Cass County Jail on October 30th, like we said before. She appeared in court the next day. And then she sat in that jail for roughly another 5 weeks before police in Fargo even knew she was here. Fargo police discovered she was there while they were conducting an interview with a different individual in custody on December 5th.
And then on the 12th, the state attorney contacted our detective to let him know that the defense attorney had produced potential exculpatory evidence, which now changes that probable cause determination. So the decision was made to coordinate an interview with Ms. Lipps and her attorney.
The interview happened December 19th. That's the one where they showed the bank records, and it was followed up with on the 22nd. And then the decision was made to dismiss the charges without prejudice on the 23rd.
And then, of course, after that, that's when she was turned out into the cold with no coat and no money.
Zabolski had something to say about that as well. He refutes that claim outright. He said a detective did offer to cover a hotel and arrange a ride home, but that Lipps declined.
We also checked with the Cass County Jail, Captain Frobig, who's the jail administrator, who advised us that they have winter clothing kits that they provide people who are released in the winter so that they are not thrown out into the elements for any reason, and further confirm that Ms. Lipps made no such request or any request prior to discharge from the Cass County Jail.
Cass County Sheriff Jesse Johnner has also come out in media reports this week to insist that people are not released from the jail into inclement weather without proper clothing or an opportunity to arrange a trip home.
Okay, well, that's definitely a clash of versions here, for sure. There has been a lot of talk of a lawsuit being brought against the city of Fargo for all this, so whatever the truth is, there tends to come out in litigation. Now, Danielle, I'm also interested still in the length of time this all took. She got here at the end of October, but it still took 5 weeks before Fargo PD even knew she was in the Cass County Jail. And I'm sorry, you know, I think people that are listening, and when I read this, I'm recalling a similar communication snafu between the sheriff's office and Fargo PD last summer. Mm-hmm. Remember those downtown shooting incidents where some deputies responded but did not notify Fargo PD in a timely manner about their involvement in the response?
Yes, so that has been a part of the story as well. When I spoke with Chief Zabolski, he was pretty adamant that law enforcement has detailed processes in place for specific reasons. They usually work well, but sometimes the process doesn't work as well as it should. So he's insisting still that there are always opportunities for improvement.
Improvement indeed. And you said it a bit ago, she was released without prejudice. What does that mean exactly?
The bank fraud case is still open and active, and Zabolski said that so far the evidence they have doesn't prove beyond a reasonable doubt that Angela Lipps is involved, but that she still hasn't been cleared as a suspect in the investigation. So if new evidence should come to light that does point to her involvement being dismissed without prejudice, that just means she could be charged again.
Goodness. Between the lawsuit and the ongoing investigation, it would appear the story is not over by a long shot. Okay, then, we'll keep our eye on this, a sharp eye on this story, Danielle. that has traveled all over the world. So anything else going on that maybe did not go viral around the globe?
They could get your personal information, like your driver's license number, and then even steal your identity.
Well, North Dakota DOT officials say if you get a call or a text insisting that your driver's license will be suspended if you don't pay a traffic ticket, that is a scam.
Number one is, of course, the prolonged period now, several operating cycles of depressed commodity prices. But on top of that, we've had them go through record inflation, which raises their input costs, and then we've had historical storms come through.
North Dakota's Industrial Commission has extended two loan programs for farmers through the Bank of North Dakota.
They're singing I Don't Want to Miss a Thing, Aerosmith. Since You've Been Gone, Kelly Clarkson. They're doing The Loadout Stay by Jackson Browne. Wide Open Spaces, Dixie Chicks.
And the Real Life School of Rock is at Northern Cass School. This week, their junior high schoolers held their second annual rock concert. There were over 220 performers who sang with a full rock band in two sold-out shows.
And I bet you there was no free bird being played in that show. That was a great story, Danielle. You should check it out online at prairiepublic.org and see all the stories, listen to them too, that the newsroom has put together. A lot of good things up there right now. So, Danielle, thanks for all that.
Absolutely. And like Eric just said, news.prairiepublic.org. That'll do it for us this week here at Prairie Beats. I'm Danielle Webster.
And I'm Eric Dethridge. I get the last word this time. We'll see you on the beat next week.
As questions remain about how this case unfolded and what accountability may follow, it's clear the story is not over yet, and we'll continue to follow it here at Prairie Public. As for our podcast, Prairie Beat, you can subscribe to it wherever you get your favorites. Still to come on Main Street, our weekly Tech with Peck, a look at wearable tech, including glasses you can wear that will tell you what you can say next. That's ahead on this Thursday's Main Street. Stay with us. This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein, pleased to be joined by my friend, George Peck. George, how are you?
Well, it's good, and I'm glad we're still friends. And
yeah,
I hope to be
friends
for many, many years in the future.
After what, about five or six of these episodes so far?
That's right, so far, so good.
All right, George, the concept today is to have a discussion about wearable tech, and I'm talking about from counting steps to tracking heart rhythms, even projecting information right in front of your eyes. Wearable tech has certainly come a very long, long way. What tech do you wear, George?
I've got the Apple Watch, and the Apple Watch has kind of been my go-to since the beginning of, you know, wearable things. I never got a Fitbit. I'm not necessarily, you can see me on the camera, dude. I'm not a fitness junkie.
Right back at you.
So,
I have a Garmin smartwatch, by the way.
Yeah, okay. But I actually, when we go for a bike ride, which we're doing now, because we were talking about being 80 degrees in Colorado here in March. So when I go for a bike ride or I go for a walk, I do launch the fitness app. And I love the fitness app on the watch, and I love looking at it on my phone, and you can see where you went and how far you rode and what your average heartbeat was and how many calories you burned. So not being a fitness geek, I do love the fitness app and the fitness capabilities of the Apple Watch.
Now I have to ask you about your Apple Watch, because I went through this with my smartwatch. I've owned one now for about 6 months or so. Do you have it monitor your sleep?
No. And you know, this is a Series 5, I think. It was very strange. My wife always gets my old tech when I buy new. It's like, I want the iPhone 17. You can have the 14. And so she had an old Apple Watch. And so I was going to give her my series like 5 and get her a 6. And I actually was nice and got her the 6. But both of these are capable of doing that. I sleep pretty well. And so I don't really want to know. So, I got to charge the watch sometime. And it's usually when I'm in bed. So I've got the watch on the nightstand, on the charger turned sideways. And it's my night clock. Because if I want to know what time it is, I bang on the table. And the accelerometer wakes it up, and I can see. So I can't have it on monitoring sleep and do that at the same time. So no, I don't want
that. For mine, it bothered me a little bit, and I don't sleep as well maybe as you do, George. And it always gave me bad news every morning when I woke up, and I didn't like that. So I decided I wasn't going to absorb myself with how bad of a sleeper that I've been. Perhaps someday it'll get a little easier to monitor that. George, will the phone ever be replaced? Are we going to be wearing tech on our bodies. We've got fitness rings. I can answer the phone on, so to speak, on my watch.
Well, you brought it up before I did. If we all remember again, we're not spring chickens here, dude. All right. So we may remember Dick Tracy and the watch phone, right?
Yeah.
So now when my phone rings, my watch rings. So basically, and by the way, the watch shows the caller ID just as well as the phone, which means most of the time it's either scam or possible spam. So I'm not sure if we all know, but the best thing is to just smash your hand over the face of the watch. Did you know about that?
I did. Yes.
Okay. And that will silence the phone, whatever, which is what happens every time my watch rings.
Yeah.
Because it's a scam phone call, probably. Will this replace the phone? And I think theoretically it might, but here's the only thing I'm going to say that might not necessarily always make that 100%. I have a computer in front of me with a big keyboard. I have a phone next to me with the two thumb thing. I cannot two thumb phone type worth a d-. Now, maybe again, it's because of the lack of spring chickenness, but I can't. Maybe if I go find an app or a typing app on my phone, I can learn to do that. But I don't know how I'm going to type on something smaller than a phone. There you go. Okay. And I haven't been super good at using that. All right. Yep. The phone's going to go away. Yep. It's going to go away. It will.
George, I wanted to ask you about these things that you and I are both wearing, our glasses. We both have them on. And of course, today, the bigger news around was Meta's Ray-Ban. That's kind of been in the news recently. Google had their take on this several years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Do you imagine these glasses becoming mainstream where we have our own heads-up display? I can see it. You can't.
That's possible. And I have a Meta Quest, the headset, the VR headset. I haven't sprung for the glasses yet, but I'm not long for no Meta glasses. I got to try them. So maybe we'll reconnect in 10 days. You may have caused me to yet spend more money on tech, man, in time for the next show.
The best app that I've seen demoed, I've not used it, are a set of glasses, and they must have been Meta, that listened to your environment and flashed answers to questions right in front of your eyes in real time. So for instance, if you were asking me questions about something, the answers would be in front of my face for me to look at, consider, or ignore. And boy, that seems pretty busy to me in real time trying to deal with that. But boy, I just don't think that I would like that, George. I want to be able to think a little bit, I think.
Well, I mean, that's a bigger AI question than just a glasses question. And it's interesting because I'm doing a demo for my company in the morning that is full on AI. And it's a very interesting demo that's raising some very interesting questions about the future of the product that I'm currently working with. And I think to a certain extent, AI infusion in anything, be it wearable tech, be it your phone, be it voice recognition, be it, there's a music service I use for my online radio station. They sent an email out this week about their AI music policy. And if you post a song on this site that has AI generated music, you're supposed to declare it. I mean, that's where we are with AI.
YouTube asks you the same thing when you post videos.
Right. So it's the wearable with AI. It just takes that to another area of potential. So, and I think I would probably prefer to have an answer to a question flashed in front of my face when the question comes in the microphone of the glasses, than the glasses put someone's different face on who I'm looking at, which is something that I am almost sorry I brought up.
George, I know that in the past, privacy issues have been a concern of yours. I know that they've been a concern of mine, and more now, we have rings that are smart. We have watches that are smart, glasses that are smart, shoes that are smart. What are your thoughts on privacy these days, George?
I've almost given up on it. And that's too bad.
That's surprising for me to hear from you.
Well, it was because it was a serious concern and always has been. But I'm thinking to myself, everything I'm doing is being tracked. I can't always go into an incognito mode on my browser when I want to look at something. And if I do, my IP address is still attached to it. It's pretty darn hard to avoid it. I have a car, a Tesla. Unless I find on the screen app and turn off tracking, you can see an icon. My wife is looking at where I'm going on the phone. I can see her looking at me. So it's the point I guess I'm making is that to try to maintain privacy is almost a full-time job. And so I think to a certain extent, I've resigned myself to it, and it's just something I'm going to have to live with. I'm not happy about it, but it's like it's an uphill battle.
I think I heard about a year ago, the average data company owns about at least 60,000 points of data on all of us.
Oh, yeah.
In the country, and able to make decisions about that. George, looking ahead, what do you think the next big leap in wearable tech may be?
Tough question. The glasses are interesting. You've only gotten a certain number of senses. Oh, you know what? Here's an idea I have. It may or may not be related. We can record sound. We can record video. We can augment it. I would like a digitized way of capturing a scent. So let's think about this for a second. It's not necessarily wearable, but it might be, where a scent can be captured through some kind of an air intake device, digitized. Then over your face or near your face is a fan with some kind of a compound that can then be re-digitized to reproduce the scent.
I can't see the mountains in North Dakota, but I can smell them.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just thinking about that as being another way of enhancing scents, because we've got the watch, we've got the glasses. What are the five senses? How do we supplement those with some kind of technology that's wearable? That's an interesting idea.
George Peck and I visit Thursdays here on Main Street. Our segment's called Tech with Peck. George, have a great weekend. We'll talk to you soon.
All right. Talk to you soon, man.
Support for PrePublic is provided by Planned Parenthood, offering health education for teens and workshops for parents on topics including health, relationships, and growing up. More at ppncs.org.
If you're listening to Main Street during the 3 p.m. Central broadcast, stay tuned for All Things Considered. It's your in-depth look at the day's top regional and national news stories. And at 8 p.m. Central tonight, right after Main Street, it's The Middle with host Jeremy Hobson. Today's topic, are you worried about losing your job to artificial intelligence? That's coming up this evening, right here on Prairie Public. This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and for teachers looking to bring science to life beyond the classroom, North Dakota's Gateway to Science offers hands-on field trips that get students exploring, experimenting, and asking big questions. From interactive gallery time to optional educator-led workshops, these visits are designed to spark curiosity for learners of all ages. And joining us now to talk about booking details and what schools can expect is Alicia Kellum with the North Dakota Gateway to Science. Alicia, welcome back to Main Street.
Thank you, Craig.
Field trips are the things I remember, Alicia, from my elementary school. Tell me more about how people can take advantage of what you have to offer.
Field trips are one of my favorite things to help with, especially on the workshop side. The excitement and the joy and the energy and the noise, quite frankly, that they bring into our gallery is so fun. And so we are really wanting to highlight field trips right now because we have entered our busy season. Field trips are available all year long, but now to the end of the year, if any schools or homeschools or anyone is looking to book field trips, definitely do so as quickly as possible. During those field trips, they are hands-on for students of all ages to enjoy our gallery space. They are 2 hours for groups of 10 or more, in order to receive a special field trip price. One of my favorite things about the field trips is that if schools or entities that come for field trips want to, they can add on workshops with one of our STEM educators for an additional price that happen right here on site. If anybody is interested, you can go online to gatewaytoscience.org and look for the Learn tag at the top or the Visit tag at the top and look for group field trips. One of our new additions that we've added just recently is that there is a downloadable teacher guide that teachers can download, and they can actually use that with their students when they get here.
So tell me, Alicia, where can educators find information and the downloadable guide that you talk about?
Yes, go to gatewaytoscience.org, look for the Visit tag at the top, and then once you're there, look for groups and field trips, and it will give you a lot more information, pricing, that downloadable guide, all the information that you could need.
Alicia Kellum, she's with North Dakota's Gateway to Science right on the banks of the Missouri River in Bismarck. Thanks, Alicia.
Thank you, Craig.
When an Oklahoma man was killed by a tiger last year, the incident put a spotlight on the safety risks of owning these animals. A federal law restricts who can own and breed big cats, but as Harvest Public Media's Anna Pope reports, some animal welfare advocates say those rules don't go far enough.
Ryan Easley had worked with big cats for years when he was fatally mauled by a tiger at a facility he owned and operated in Oklahoma last September.
Tonight, a shocking tragedy at an Oklahoma wildlife preserve. A tiger handler mauled to death by a tiger in front of a crowd.
A statement from Growler Pines Tiger Preserve, where the incident occurred, said, quote, "This tragedy is a painful reminder of both the beauty and the unpredictability of the natural world." Easley's death resurfaced concerns from advocates about the safety risks of owning big cats. The Big Cat Public Safety Act, a federal law passed in 2022, restricts who can own and breed big cats like lions, tigers, and leopards, and bans up-close public contact with these animals. Rebecca Wish is an expert of animal welfare law at Michigan State University. She says the act was an improvement over the way things used to be and helps to control unregulated breeding.
You know, the whole idea of how many captive cats there are is just unfathomable. And hopefully this does lead to fewer captive cats, but I'm not entirely sure it will.
Before the Big Cat Public Safety Act, Wish says there was a patchwork of state laws, some stricter than others.
It didn't preempt those laws, but kind of cooperates with those state laws. So the state laws that are more stringent with regard to big cats still stay in place.
Animal exhibits that can own big cats need a license through the U.S. Department of Agriculture and must follow specific federal standards. But some advocacy groups say animal exhibitors should seek out an outside certification from independent groups that ensure higher standards of care for animals and staff. One of those groups, the Association of Zoos and Aquariums, or AZA, has certified about 240 institutions. Dan Ash is the group's president and CEO. He says to get accredited, organizations must meet specific requirements, like having sufficient habitat space for animals.
So the difference in care is substantial, and that's why increasingly we're telling people, if you want to see these animals, go to places that really know how to care for them.
Ash acknowledges that getting this accreditation can be time-consuming and expensive. Some animal exhibitors argue these extra certifications are unnecessary and existing federal rules are enough. But for zoologist Trista Fisher, the outside accreditation is a sign that safety for animals, guests, and staff is a priority. She's a tiger expert at the Minnesota Zoo, which is accredited through the AZA. She says when these animals cause injuries or deaths at any facility, it hurts conservation efforts meant to protect them.
What the problem is they're doing these pay-to-play opportunities. They're putting the public at risk when they're interacting with animals, whether that be a small animal or a large animal, or they themselves are interacting inappropriately, in my opinion, with a large, dangerous animal.
Harvest Public Media contacted 6 facilities in the central U.S. that house big cats, but they either declined to comment or didn't respond to interview requests. In Eureka Springs, Arkansas, Turpentine Creek Wildlife Refuge has been taking in abandoned and abused big cats for more than 30 years. It's accredited through the Global Federation of Animal Sanctuaries. Refuge founder Tanya Smith says many of these animals can't survive in the wild and deserve quality care.
We've rescued from 19 states now, from all over the country, plus two international rescues we've been on also just in the last year. So we've seen just about everything you can imagine, but I say that until we go on the next rescue, and it's just as bad.
She stresses these are wild animals, and when they're kept in unsuitable or dangerous conditions, sanctuaries like hers are left to pick up the pieces. I'm Anna Pope, Harvest Public Media.
Harvest Public Media is a collaboration of public media newsrooms across the Midwest and Great Plains. The news footage came from ABC.
This is Dakota Datebook for March 19th. Even if a day starts under bright sunshine, winter on the Great Plains is unforgiving, and a snowstorm can close in rapidly. Such a day was March 15th, 1920. William Miner arrived at the school to take his children home. He tied his horse and put Hazel, Emmett, and Meredith Miner in the sleigh. He told them to wait while he got his own horse. But the horse pulling the sleigh grew anxious and set off. When William returned, the sleigh was gone. It was usually an easy trip, but on this day it was anything but easy. 15-year-old Hazel took the reins, but became lost in the blinding snow. Then the sleigh overturned. Hazel put down blankets in the shelter of the overturned sleigh for the younger children to lie on and cover them with a heavy robe. She opened her coat and lay on top of them to keep them warm. Throughout the long night, Hazel had the children sing songs and told them stories to keep them awake. When a search party found them 15 hours later, they found Hazel's frozen body lying protectively on top of her younger siblings, both of whom survived. One newspaper editor wrote that Hazel proved herself a heroine whose devotion and self-sacrifice is rarely equaled by one of her years. Hazel's funeral, held on this date in 1920, was attended by family, friends, and total strangers who were moved by her sacrifice. Her story touched North Dakotans across the state. Every family on the Great Plains could easily imagine that their own children might meet Hazel's fate. 12 of her classmates served as pallbearers. In 1936, Louis Lemkuhl put his thoughts down on paper as a monument was erected in her memory. He wrote, "There is another courage which is perhaps greater and even more sublime than the courage of men who give their lives in desperate conflict on some great battlefield. Surely it is well that the memory of this young girl and what she did shall not be lost nor forgotten." Hazel is buried at the Center Community Cemetery in Center, North Dakota. A statue commissioned by Governor L.B. Hanna stands in front of the Oliver County Courthouse. It commemorates her courage and sacrifice in saving the lives of her brother and sister at the cost of her own. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Dr. Carol Butcher. I'm Meryl Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming here on Prairie Public.
Did you know that when you support Prairie Public's radio service starting as little as $5 a month, you'll receive access to one of our best Prairie Public member benefits, PBS Passport. Passport lets you stream your favorite PBS shows on your Roku, Fire Stick, Apple TV, or Smart TV. Watch the programs you love all on your own time. Unlock entire seasons of programs early and discover new TV series, movies, and musical performances, all available to you when you support Prairie Public, your local NPR and PBS station.
Kark Island is Iran's Persian Gulf oil export hub. The U.S. has already attacked the island, and now President Trump has suggested future strikes could hit the oil infrastructure.
We can do that on 5 minutes' notice, it'll be over.
We consider the implications for the oil market and the U.S. military on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Basin Electric Power Cooperative, headquartered in Bismarck, serving over 3 million consumers in 9 states, with electricity from coal, natural gas, wind, solar, and hydro.
And that wraps up this Thursday's Main Street here on Prairie Public. We are deeply grateful that you've spent time with us. Monday on Main Street, we preview the teachers' protest when Norwegian educators defied the Nazis. It's a film that's going to be shown March 24th at the Sons of Norway in Fargo. Until then, we hope you have a great North Dakota weekend, and we look forward to seeing you again right here on Main Street.